From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Well, during the first half of the show today, we'll be speaking with Andrew Fracknoy regarding the upcoming total solar eclipse. On August 21st, for the first time in 40 years, people in the United States will be able to see this spectacle across a 70-mile-wide path that will run across the country. We'll hear about the science behind the eclipse, why this eclipse is so special, and also get some tips on the best way to view it.
That's right. In the second half of the show, we have lots of news items to go over and cover. We're a little behind in that. So I'm going to give you some news on other things like Utah's mountain lion populations, Park City's feral and house cat problem. My words.
We're not going to refer to that as a population as well?
No, you prefer to... population, yeah, problem. Mm-hmm. Spelled problem. Disappearing Arctic sea ice, that's a problem. And that's an annual problem. why yellow jackets are actually good for something, specifically your garden. That's something I learned this weekend. And you got some news items, too, on some really...
Yeah,
wonderful stuff.
Well, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about ticks because that's a growing issue. And it seems that there's maybe a growing number here in our area.
Really? So there's a population problem.
There's a population of ticks
too,
as well.
And they have some consequences associated with them. So we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Support of KPCW comes from Zions Bank International Banking and Foreign Exchange Services. Zions Bank. We haven't forgotten who keeps us in business. More information available online at zionsbank.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the first half of the show is Andrew Fracknoy to talk about the upcoming total solar eclipse. He's an award-winning science educator, and he's the chair of the astronomy department at Foothill College near San Francisco, and is devoted to sharing the excitement of astronomy with the public. He's active in the American Astronomical Society Eclipse Task Force, the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, and the National Science Teachers Association. Also, I think this is very notable, he even has an asteroid named after him.
What?
Asteroid Fracknoy.
Oh.
So, Andrew, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure, but I want to reassure your listeners that Asteroid Fracknoy is a very boring asteroid in the main belt of asteroids and is not a threat to the Earth ever.
Good. You wouldn't let it happen.
Not a threat yet, you should say. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to join us this morning on This Green Earth. And I know Nell and I, we usually cover environmental, planetary, earthbound environmental events, but we can't pass this opportunity. The last time it happened here in the U.S. was 40 years ago?
Well, 40 years ago, but it wasn't visible from Utah. The last time we had one that crossed the country was 99 years ago. It really is a rare event. And I was thinking about the fact that you guys had this wonderful environmental show and about the Earth. And so I wanted to mention something that is really a unique Earth phenomenon as far as this eclipse is concerned. And this has maybe come as a surprise to many of our listeners that only from Earth is it true that the sun in the sky and the moon in the sky happen to be the same size. If you look up, the sun is a lot further away, but it's a lot bigger. Yeah, the moon is closer, but it's a lot smaller. And it just happens to work out from Earth that they're exactly the same size. And when they're lined up just the right way, the moon can cover the sun, and we can get a total eclipse of the sun.
Wow.
That's astounding.
That is.
What are the odds of that?
Not true from any other planet in the solar system, by the way.
Right. So once again, we're number one as far as...
That's right. If we just keep it up, good
yeah,
yes,
exactly.
We're number one.
So let's talk through the basic mechanics of a solar eclipse here. Explain, you know, what it is and how it happens.
Right. So what's happening on August 21st, on Monday morning, is that the moon will get in front of the sun slowly and cover up more and more of the sun as time goes on. I looked up the times for Utah. So on August 21st, the eclipse for you guys will begin at 10:13 in the morning. And you will not have a total eclipse. As you mentioned at the beginning, the eclipse will be total only over a narrow path this time that starts in Oregon and goes diagonally across the country to South Carolina. But there'll be a pretty spectacular partial eclipse in Utah where part of the sun will be covered. And so by about 11:33 that morning, August 21st, about 90% of the sun will be covered from your vantage point. And then it'll all be over by about 12:50, 12:57 or so. So you have a long time to go out sometime that morning, that Monday morning, August 21, and see a good part of the sun covered. The problem is, of course, it's very dangerous to look at the sun when it's out. Normally, when the sun is completely out, your common sense tells you don't look at it and it hurts. But sometimes when an eclipse happens, people get overly enthusiastic and they stare at the sun for too long. So that's the first thing we want to tell our listeners. It's much better to use special glasses or to project an image, and we can talk more about that.
Let's jump into that. So what kinds of, you know, materials or glasses can you look through to make it safe?
Well, this is the thing that I'm a little bit proud of. I'm part of a small group of scientists who have persuaded a foundation here in California and Google to distribute free of charge 2 million of these special paper glasses that you can use to view the eclipse through public libraries nationwide. So our listeners, the first thing they should do if they want to get eclipse glasses is to go and ask their public library, are they participating in the StarNet program for giving out free eclipse glasses? And if they are, these glasses are quite safe. They usually say certified on the back that they've been certified to the optical standards we need. And grab a pair of glasses while your library still has them. If your library doesn't have them, they're quite inexpensively available. Two companies make them reliably in the United States, American Paper Optics and Rainbow Symphony. And many science centers will have them. Many university departments will have them. There's some talk that Walmart will have a display of them. Many hardware stores will have them. Just make sure that they say certified on the back. They look like the 3D glasses you used to get in the movies with paper and then a dark, dark, dark plastic eyepiece through which you look, and they cut out most of the rays of the sun.
So the material that you're looking through is cutting out certain wavelengths, or how's that working?
Right, and just cutting out most of the light and the ultraviolet. It's a filter, essentially. And when you look through these glasses, it's perfectly safe to stare at the sun. And you can use them not just during the eclipse. Later on, right now, the sun is at a minimum, so there are not too many sunspots. But in a few years, if you want to use these same glasses and look at the sun, you can often see big groups of sunspots.
Whoa.
But that's one way, is the glasses. Then if you don't have those, my favorite way to view the eclipse is to grab a colander. You know, the thing that you use to wash vegetables or fruit?
Right.
That colander is full of little holes. And if you hold a colander over your shoulder with your back to the sun, so you make a shadow of it on the pavement, the shadow acts like a pinhole projector. And you see many, many images of the eclipsed sun on the pavement in that shadow. And then when it's too hot, you can put the colander over your head as a fashion accessory.
And you can do that almost any day, too.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's amazing, because I had an experience where I think this was back in the late 90s. I was living in New York City at the time. There was a partial eclipse, and it was midday. And I could see the eclipse, the shadow of the eclipse, on the ground as the sunlight filtered through leaves in a tree. So
he created the same pattern.
So I saw all these little tiny eclipses when I, you know, focused on it. It was amazing. So that's the same phenomenon.
Same idea. And if you're near a tree with a lot of leaves, where they're interlocking leaves or interweaving leaves, then the holes through the leaves act like pinhole projectors too. Exactly the same way.
Right.
Now, if you don't have that, another way to do it is to get a hand mirror or a compact mirror, a woman's compact mirror, cover most of it with cardboard, leaving a hole about the size of a dime. And you need to practice this in advance. But if you can use that covered mirror with the little hole just to grab an image of the sun and project it onto a wall, then everybody around you can see, say, a safe and bigger image of the eclipse sun. So that takes some practice. I would do that on Saturday and Sunday and practice.
Sure.
And then be ready to be the hero of your neighborhood on August 21st when you can project such an image.
Fantastic. Now, how far north would I have to, say, get in my car and travel if I wanted to see from Salt Lake City, from this area, if I wanted to catch the 100% coverage?
Well, so this is a complicated issue. You have to be in this zone, which is about 60 to 70 mile wide, and that zone goes through 12 states, so you have to be in one of those 12 states. So let's see, I'm looking at a map. If you're in Utah, you're going to need to... Sorry?
Yeah, go ahead.
If we're so in you're going to need to go... to a state that has it. What's the closest state? I need to get to a map. But are you guys closer to Idaho? Mm-hmm.
Yes. So it's,
yeah, so Idaho would be probably the closest state.
Okay. So the farther north we can go up and we could see. It's not that far. The point is, if we wanted to leave early in the morning, we can be in Idaho in a few hours.
Now that's the problem. So that's where I want to be very careful. This is what our task force, we have a small task force of astronomers, and we've been tearing our hair out about a lot of things, and this is one of them. It turns out 47 million people in the United States live within 100 miles of the eclipse zone, but not in the zone. And many people have been making plans for over a year to go see the total eclipse in this zone. So already most of the accommodations are sold out, most of the campgrounds are gone, although there's still some left if you search around. If that morning a whole bunch of these 47 million people decide, hey, honey, let's grab the kids and get in the car, and we'll just drive up there that morning, there is going to be utter gridlock in the road, particularly because most of the eclipse is over rural areas and small towns, where there aren't interstate freeways and large roads. So if you decide that you do want to drive up and see the eclipse, I would plan ahead and try not to do it that morning. Try to be there the day before, maybe camp out. If you have any friends or relatives in the zone, now's the time to remind them how much you miss them and that you want to see them August 21st. And if you want maps of where the eclipse is going to be total, detailed maps, the best place to go is a website called GreatAmericanEclipse.com, all one word, GreatAmericanEclipse.com. That's a map maker who's made detailed maps of every state and can show you exactly where to go.
And so that name of that website actually brings up an interesting point. So this eclipse, is it only visible from the United States? Will other places on the planet be able to see this one?
The total eclipse is visible in one country and one country only, which is the United States. That's why people are calling it the Great American Eclipse. I'm sure the administration in Washington will take full credit for it the minute they wake up to the fact that it's happening.
Yeah.
They're a little busy right now with other things. But yes, this is a U.S. eclipse. Now, the partial eclipse will be visible all over North America from Canada down to below Mexico. So we estimate 500 million people will be able to see the partial eclipse of the sun.
Okay.
And that's why we've tried to get information out to so many people. That's why we've written this children's book that my colleague and I have written, because we want to be sure that all those 500 million people are prepared.
Well, we'll jump right into that in a second. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Andrew Fracknoy. He's an expert on the upcoming total solar eclipse that we'll see here in the United States. So, Andrew, how long will this eclipse be visible? Will the total eclipse be visible? And is that about average for total eclipses?
So that's there's good news and bad news. The good news is that the eclipse has the courtesy to come over the United States. But the bad news is that it's a very short eclipse compared to what eclipses can be. Huh. At best, the eclipse lasts about 2 minutes and a half. And in a couple of places, it's 2 minutes and 40 seconds. But in most places, it's 2 minutes or a little more than 2 minutes, which is a little bit of a short total eclipse. Now, the partial eclipse we discussed earlier, that can last for a much longer time. In Utah, it'll last 2 hours and 46 minutes as it slowly covers the sun, as the moon slowly covers the sun. But if you go into the total eclipse zone, it's very short.
So what can scientists learn from eclipses?
Well, this is the amazing thing. If you go to where the eclipse is total, it is really quite spectacular. And all of a sudden, as the moon completely covers the sun, the sky goes dark. It's as if it's night in the middle of the day. And as the sun's bright face is completely covered, the stars come out. There's an incredibly hushed environmental picture where you see darkness where you didn't expect it. And then the sun's faint atmosphere, which we never see in the regular brightness of the sun, comes out as if there were a halo around the sun. Mm-hmm. And that faint atmosphere was discovered during eclipses. And from Earth, it can only be seen during eclipses. So we have studied and continue to study that atmosphere in which there's quite a bit of activity. Great tongues of hot material leave the sun and move out into the solar system. There's tremendous heating going on there because of magnetism on the sun. So it's a complicated, ever-changing atmosphere, and we study that during eclipses.
Okay. Now, we talked, Nell and I were talking about what environmental impacts there might be when suddenly it goes, like you say, Andrew, kind of dark in the middle of the day. How do plants and animals react to that event? And now, what you did a little research on that, or Andrew, do you have anything to add?
I'd love to hear what research Nell did, but I'll just mention that we are eager to learn more about this.
Right.
And the California Academy of Sciences is actually undertaking a citizen science project called Life Response, in which they're asking observers in every state to use a phone app to report in during the total eclipse what animals are doing, so that they will have a database from now on of animal responses.
That's interesting. I'll download that one onto my phone for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, citizen science. Yeah, citizen science at work.
Well, yeah. I mean, as Chris mentioned, as an ecologist, I was of course interested in like how does this impact wildlife or insects? And as you said, there's not a ton of data out there. Reports from people seem to say that animals start acting like it's nighttime. Birds will go quiet and then start chirping like wild as if it's dawn. They think it's sort of a short day. There are some bits and pieces that I found. In 1991, research at the researchers from the University of Illinois and Florida's Bear University traveled to Arizona, and they recorded that the cicadas stopped chirping during the eclipse. Hmm. Their hypothesis seems to be that it was actually based on the temperature change rather than the light.
Wow.
And then looking even further back than that, there are some isolated things. People have looked at the behavior of rock bees during an eclipse. In the 80s, some folks looked at a population of bulls. Researchers have looked at captive squirrels. It's like this weird mishmash of small little bits and pieces. So it'll be interesting to see what the California Academy of Sciences learns from this.
Well, and what flowers might do, et cetera.
Right, the night blooming flower. You know,
so
like
their petals close up over just that short period of time. So, all right, so we'll be paying attention to that.
I want to jump in, with a quick question. So, you know, over the millennia, I suppose, this has been something that the human population on Earth has been able to witness. And I know that there have been some interesting sort of like myths and stories around it and what it is and what it does. So can you share with us one or two of those?
Right. So in the Earth today, we understand exactly what's going on. But long ago, people were very confused what was happening when all of a sudden in their area, the sun started going away. And as you might imagine, the most common explanation was that a monster or a dragon was attacking the sun, which was really bad news.
Right.
And so traditions arose, particularly in Asia, that what you need to do is to frighten that monster away. And so people would come out during an eclipse with pots and pans and bang them together, making a lot of noise to frighten the monster. And you know what? It always worked. The monster did go away. So this was a fun tradition. And sadly, even today, there are places where people believe, for example, that pregnant women shouldn't go out during an eclipse because the rays of the eclipse are bad for the unborn child, which is nonsensical. There are no special rays during the eclipse. It's just the sun's rays are being cut down a little bit. So there's no danger to children or anyone like that. And if your school teacher or someone says, oh, my God, let's keep all the kids inside because of the dangers of the eclipse, it's good to remind them that there's no special danger here. You just need glasses or a method of projecting the sun to make sure the kids are looking at it safely.
Well, while we're on that note, let's talk about this children's book that you've released.
Well, so the National Science Teachers Association has published a book that a colleague and I have written called When the Sun Goes Dark, because we looked around and there weren't really any good books out there that explained what happens during eclipses, both of the sun and the moon, to kids. And so this book, When the Sun Goes Dark, is a story about two grandparents who are eclipse chasers, who are explaining why their passion is eclipses to their grandchildren, and the grandchildren ask a lot of good questions. It's an illustrated picture book. And we suggest as part of that story some experiments, very simple everyday material experiments that families can do at home, let's say with a lamp and a tennis ball and a kid's head, to simulate eclipses, to make them understand what's going on. So by the time the eclipse comes, August 21st, your kids can be ready and can understand exactly what's going to happen in the sky, maybe tell their friends. Half the schools in the United States will be in session and half won't. So for half the population, it'll be the parents who are responsible for explaining what's happening to their kids. So we hope this book, When the Sun Goes Dark, will help people understand what's going on.
Well, here we're fortunate that the Park City Library has a full program scheduled for this time period where you can go to the Park City Library. They'll have those special glasses that you mentioned. They'll have some other activities. They'll have some scientists, researchers there to give a little briefing prior to the eclipse. So there's a full, a robust event going on August 21st down at the Park City Library, and we have time in the coming weeks to broadcast that and showcase that. So we're on top of things here, Andrew, at least with our with
it
the
good
folks.
It sounds great, and this is what's happening around the country, that libraries, it makes me very happy that libraries all over the country are doing this. And
yes, absolutely. So are you still there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Great.
Hey, we got a few more minutes. If you have a few more minutes, we have a bunch more questions we're getting.
Absolutely. I'm at your disposal.
All right. Well, when's the next one?
Ah, so if you miss this one, I have good news about that. Usually it's decades before a country like the U.S. gets another total eclipse, but by a cosmic coincidence, the next one is April 8th, 2024. And it will also cross the United States, but diagonally to the one that we're having this year. So other states will get to see it. And so you might want to put that on your phone calendar now. April 8th, 2024 is the next eclipse.
April 8th, 2024. All
right. So how far in advance are these, like, are these lined out and predicted? Obviously, you know, we know a lot of math about everything and the solar system is moving. I mean, how far are we looking forward at these?
Well, this is something I enjoy talking to my students about. I teach introductory astronomy in college. And it is, you know, we argue so much about what's not known in science, and there are all these political questions about what do we know and what we don't know. But scientists are very good. Once they understand the system, they're very good at making predictions. And it's a testament to our understanding of the solar system that we can predict the motions and therefore these eclipses hundreds of years in advance. So we know for hundreds of years when the eclipses are coming, exactly the time that they're going to be happening, where they're going to be visible. There are people at NASA and elsewhere who publish a whole atlas of future eclipses and past eclipses. We can go back in time and figure out what eclipses were visible to our ancestors in different parts of the world. So this is one thing that we scientists have covered.
And like you say, we can go back, too, and see when all these prior eclipses occurred. One thing it's interesting, as a sidebar, I've been reading John Wesley Powell's book about his trip down the Colorado, which is a fantastic book, by the way. And at one point during the trip, he discovers that there's supposed to be a solar eclipse. Now, this is back in 1869, Andrew, so I don't think it was a full eclipse, but it was enough that he and another man scrambled up some 2,000 feet up from the base of the Colorado, where they were, up to get to a mountaintop nearby. They set up their equipment. They're excited to see this. And you know what happened? It rained. It poured. It was like the heaviest rainstorm they'd experienced They were drenched. And then they had to come back down. But even back then, you know, John Wesley Powell was excited to see this solar eclipse, and he was going to take measurements of it, and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a little sidebar.
No, that's a wonderful story. And that's the other thing we should perhaps make sure your listeners are aware of, is that one other factor is the weather.
Yeah.
And it's, of course, no good if it's completely cloudy or rainy, or for those of us here in San Francisco, completely foggy on that day. So it's important to keep track of the weather predictions for August 21st as we get closer as well.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, there are, how many millions of people that live within 100? Okay, 47 million people that live within 100 miles of the eclipse,
right,
but outside of the zone. But what about international travel? Is this something that, you know, eclipse seekers from around the world are also kind of pouring into the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely. And they've been, because as we pointed out, these eclipses are known way in advance. Most of the eclipses that happen on Earth, given the Earth being two-thirds water, happen over very unpopulated areas, let's put it that way, often in the middle of the ocean where only rich people can take a yacht to get there somehow. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that this is over a well-settled and reasonably peaceful area of the world has drawn thousands, maybe tens of thousands of visitors from around the world, and they've known about this for a year and a half. So many of the hotels and the other accommodations were taken by both international and U.S. visitors, what we might call eclipse aficionados.
I got a question from a listener who says, asks, will we be able to observe this eclipse from space?
Yes, so NASA's intending to take all its assets, as NASA calls it, all the satellites that can be useful in this way, and observe the eclipse. Now, from space, we can make artificial eclipses. There are satellites that are observing the sun and measuring it from space all the time. But the interesting thing is to look back on the Earth and to see the shadow spot on the Earth from space. If you Google that, there are many beautiful pictures of the Earth from the International Space Station and other space probes, which show past eclipses with a beautiful dark spot clearly visible where the eclipse is happening on Earth.
Yeah, well, I have I wanted to ask you a little bit. We're almost out of time, but I want to ask you a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in astronomy and study?
That's an interesting story. I'm actually an immigrant, like so many people in the United States. Right. Our family escaped from Hungary back in the 1950s, and we were so happy to be taken in by the United States, but I didn't speak a word of English when I got here at the age of 11. And my mom had this great idea of helping me relearn English. She spoke English through comic books. And so I read space comic books to learn English. And I got fascinated with space at age 11 and then began, as I learned English, to read books. I went to the library and devoured the astronomy section of our library in New York City. And from then I suddenly started to realize, wow, this isn't just for comic books. There are people who actually do this for a living. And I was hooked after that.
And eventually, you had an asteroid named after you. And I assume that was because you discovered that asteroid?
No. Actually, the asteroid, the discoverers of asteroids discover many asteroids.
Right.
An asteroid named after you by a colleague. So it was a colleague of mine at the Lowell Observatory who I was very overwhelmed. This did because of my work in public education. To name an asteroid after me. So part of what I've been doing for most of my career is what I hope we're doing here, which is to help people understand in everyday words what's happening in the sky. I've written a textbook and other things, and so this was a great honor to befall someone who's an educator.
Oh, that's wonderful. And where do you teach?
I teach at a small college in San Francisco, near San Francisco, called Foothill College.
Yes.
But I'm just about to retire after 45 years of teaching, and I'm going to teach in two universities here in San Francisco itself. I'm going to teach retired people adult classes. Mm. I want to now share my excitement about astronomy with adults.
Fantastic.
Wonderful.
And where are some good websites people can go that you would recommend to learn more about, eclipses or other aspects of astronomy?
Thank you for asking. Let me mention a couple. My co-author and I on this children's book, When the Sun Goes Dark, have written an 8-page free booklet all about the eclipse and how to observe it safely. And you can get to that. It's by the nonprofit National Science Teachers Association by going to NSTA, National Science Teachers Association, NSTA.org / Solar Science, all one word, Solar Science.
Right.
That's a web page from which you can link directly to this 8-page PDF booklet, and you can copy that and send it to your relatives all over the country and download it for your classes. So that's one way to learn some of the things we've been talking about on this program. Another really good website is the American Astronomical Society has an eclipse.aas.org. And the American Astronomical Society is the professional group of astronomers in the United States, and they've put this non-technical website for the public together. There's also a NASA website and the Great American Eclipse website. I like that a lot because Mike Zeiler, the guy who does it, is a cartographer. And so he's put together the most wonderful maps and lots of good information about the eclipse, greatamericaneclipse.com.
Wonderful resources.
Great.
Well, we will post those for our listeners to take advantage of. Thanks so much, Andrew, for joining us today.
Oh, what a great pleasure. And I wish your listeners and you clear skies on August 21.
Exactly.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you again sometime around the end of March 2024.
Sounds great.
For the next
yes,
one.
Absolutely.
Not before
Make
that.
It a date.
All right. Yes. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take a break for some underwriters and sponsors. And when we come back, we've got some news items to cover on a bunch of topics from mountain lions to ticks. Really? Yes. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Miller Orthodontics is a proud supporter of The Randy Barton Show. Since 1988, my wife and I have provided a combined 45 years of orthodontic care. For our Invisalign patients, we provide digital scanning and imaging technology that eliminates the need for wet molds of your teeth. More information is at m2ortho.com.
This is Brenda with Republic Services, your local provider for recycling and garbage collection. Information about what is acceptable to put in your curbside recycling bin can be found at summitcountyrecycles.org. Please help Summit County be clean. Remember to recycle.
The Park City UPS stores are back to support Minor Nation Report, Park City High School Sports, and the Minor Detail Show on KPCW. The Park City UPS stores have two locations at Kimball Junction and next to the movie theater on Park Ave. Open Monday through Saturday. Information at the upsstorelocal.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, concepts of sustainability, and today, solar eclipses.
That's right.
That was a great conversation with Andrew. If you didn't catch all of it or so, go to our KPCW website and you can catch the replay of today's show and listen in on all the information, all the things you need to watch
right.
this.
How to see the
eclipse
from here or elsewhere. And not only is he the chair of the astronomy department at Foothill College, he also has an asteroid named after him. So that's how you know he's an expert.
that's apparently the marker. So let's turn our attention to some news items, some things that catch our eye as we're doing our research for this show. Do you get the weekly news releases from the Department of Wildlife Resources?
Yes.
No? Okay. Well, here's one that caught my eye because it makes me so angry. Here's the title of it. The DWR recommends slight increase in cougar hunting permits. Okay? And I'm going to read you some of the excerpts, not the whole thing, but some of the excerpts of this. This is from the Department of Wildlife Resources. And remember, in Utah, wildlife is a resource.
That's right.
It's not wildlife protection or even wildlife management. It's a resource. So here's what they say. Cougars are doing well in Utah. So well, in fact, that a few more hunters might be allowed to hunt them this fall. This past year, hunters were given the opportunity to take. Now, that's their word, right?
Right.
It's a taking.
Yeah.
You're taking them. You take. That's the verb. I'm going to use the more straightforward. Let's use the more kill. Opportunity to shoot and kill 531 cougars in the state.
Ooh.
That's the permits that they're going to put out, 531. Now, I did a little research that they estimate there's about, plus or minus, about 3,000 cougars in the state, okay? So they think
although
that
this is one of those really tough to estimate species. So it's probably
the range,
you know,
was as low as 2,500 and as high as almost 4,500.
Right.
So I'm kind of picking the middle, but you're right. This is a hard number to get a fix on.
Yeah.
But apparently they feel confident enough that they can issue these number of permits, that they will offer up to 531 permits that one individual could get to hunt and kill cougar, all right, for sport or otherwise. Now, for the upcoming season, biologists with the Division of Wildlife Resources are recommending that hunters be allowed to shoot and kill 565. So last year it was 531.
And so it's usually, if I'm remembering this right, around that 500 number. It has been for the past several years.
Yes, it has been. But this year, they've asked for an increase of about 7% to 565 permits that will be available. Now, they say every hunter won't kill a cougar, so the number of cougars killed will actually be lower than 565. For example, last year, again, they had 531 permits that they put out, but only 400 cougars were killed last year. Now that's 400 cougars. When you kill a cougar, the hunter has to bring it into the DWR offices, where they identify the sex of the cougar, the age. They do some research on it, so they can collect their data.
Mm-hmm.
But that's up to the hunter to do that. They're required to do that. Now, this is what they say. I don't want to spend too much more time because this. I just find this reprehensible that people go out. I can understand if you are managing sheep and livestock, cattle, and you have a cougar that is preying on those animals, and it becomes kind of a management thing for that landowner. Etc. And maybe there's
safety issues.
There's evidence to support that the taking of these animals is required at times, but to take these, to shoot and kill cougars just for sport, that I just find completely objectionable. I don't get it. Let me put it that way. So yeah. I just don't get it why you would do that. All right. So these are the numbers: 565 permits that will be available. The plan says they have a cougar management plan. The plan says that not more than 40% of the cougars hunters can kill can be females. Now, I don't know. Can you tell a female from a male mountain lion out in the wild now? Is there visible?
Let's hope so.
Well, okay. So somehow they're hoping that only 40% of the cougars that are shot and killed will be females. I don't know if they put a stop to the hunting after that or what. That's their goal. During the last season, only 28% of the cougars killed were females, and 23% of the cougars taken were 5 years of age or older. So this, I just don't get it. And I really wish the DWR could at least have the honesty, instead of saying we're going to take, or we're going to harvest, we're going to manage populations. No, this is basically shooting and killing cougars. And they have bobcat permits you can get. That's why it's the Department of Wildlife Resources. So this is what's going on, and there's your opportunity. If you want to learn more about this, go to wildlife.utah.gov. They have public meetings. You can submit comments, email comments to them if you're really concerned.
I think there's like
concerned.
Cougar management, like state working group, from time to time.
Well, they have a management plan, and they revise that management
group
plan
put together
based on the numbers they get. Now, this doesn't include. I was thinking, this is the number of mountain lions that could be shot and killed by hunters. It doesn't include the deaths that cougars or mountain lions occur with respect to things like highway deaths. There's always mountain lions that get hit accidentally. Natural causes, old age or other injuries they incur. There's
harsh
there's
weather
deaths.
Conditions, right? A severe winter, things.
And of course, when a female is shot and killed, there's probably a good chance that there's cubs back in the den that are now have abandoned. And they're not going to survive. Probably not going to survive. So there's the deaths of them too that go. So there's a lot of collateral. Additional or collateral damage that's done the cougar populations, and it's astounding. In a state that one of the more popular universities has as its mascot a cougar, here we shoot. They decide that roughly 560 of it, let's say 3,000 or 4,000. Let's say that's 15% of the population can go and be shot and killed each year. All right, sorry, but that's just
downer.
downer, but realistic.
Yeah,
that's
and
reality.
Interesting to know what's going on, right? Yeah. To know what's happening in that area.
Thanks, DWR, for those news releases. All right, what do you have?
Well, I'm working on a segue here from mountain lions to ticks.
Oh.
But here's
okay, ticks,
so
I was a house cat.
So
speaking of cats,
that's right. There's
we'll get to
so
that.
Much
Let's
to
do
talk
the,
about.
The tick thing.
So ticks.
Since we've lost our audience anyway.
Yeah, nobody's listening anymore, so it doesn't matter. Well, this spring, around the time when we were still having a bunch of rain, I heard a few reports and stories of people finding ticks on themselves after they'd been out hiking, trail running, whatever, in Round Valley. And so I was curious as to, you know, what kinds of ticks these might be. Of course, having grown up in the Northeast and knowing that Lyme disease is now spreading elsewhere,
right.
I wondered about that. And so I just did a little bit of research as far as what we might find here in Utah. So Utah State University did a study in 2015 where they surveyed throughout the state using – when they survey for ticks, they'll almost use like – a cape. They call it a flannel cape that they sort of like wipe over the bushes and over the vegetation, and that's something that the ticks would grab onto, thinking that this is like, this is a potential
so
food source, right? This is a taking of ticks. And they found, they looked at 157 sites all around the state.
Hmm.
And of all the ticks gathered, 119 were on the species capable of spreading an illness like Lyme disease.
Wow.
But none of the 119 tested positive for it. So it's not known to be endemic to Utah at this point. So you don't have to worry about that.
Lyme disease. But tick populations
are spreading. And what's interesting is it's not just that one species is spreading. It's like, you know, the many species that we have in this country are spreading. And so not only are we seeing an increase in numbers at any given site, but also different species. So your area might not have one, historically had one particular tick, but it might have that now. And I think there's a lot to learn in this area. This sounds like there's a lot of research going on. But again, there's like, this is kind of a downer. Along with these warmer temperatures, these ticks are spreading a larger variety of diseases in different places because they're bringing them from where they came from,
right,
and picking up new ones. And so here in Utah, there are some resources as far as what kinds of ticks and diseases to watch out for, whether that's the, you know, Colorado. Oh, gosh, I'm forgetting the name of it. You know, there's Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever,
right,
and there's Lyme disease, and
so
there's
a
reoccurring fever, and there.
Bourbon virus is
exactly.
A woman died from bourbon virus, a very rare type of virus, viral infection, and it's suspected that it was due to a tick bite. So,
right.
So with warmer temperatures, that means and more, you know, more traveling and more people bringing, you know, Fido and Snowball back east with them, you know, or other areas where ticks are well established. You know, your dog and cat can be a carrier of these ticks back here. So
we'll follow up on this, and we'll try to find somebody here that's an expert in the state about what species we're seeing, what diseases we've seen in this area, and what we can do about that. But I should make a note on the tail of that mountain lion conversation that generally increasing the number of high-tier predators like mountain lions decreases carriers of ticks like elk, deer, and moose.
So again, unintended
consequences. Things, like the number of white-tailed deer in the Northeast, you know, when that's booming.
Right.
The issue with the ticks that carry Lyme disease becomes a bigger issue as well. So.
Right. So all those linkages, we're always talking about the linkages and unintended consequences associated with trying to manage one population and the results associated with that. And here we have it. That's a good point.
Yeah. Okay. So it is. It's all connected, you know.
All right. We got a couple more minutes. Let me get in a couple of underwriters and we'll come back and cover a last news item or two. It's This Green Earth.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We got a few minutes for a couple other news items. One I wanted to get in while we're on insects is another insect that is usually seen as a pest, right? Yellow jackets.
Right. We're afraid of them.
We're afraid of them for good reason. People are dramatically allergic to them. Mm-hmm. If you see one, you know, the first response is that you got to kill it. But I did a little research on that, and I see them hovering around my plants and stuff. And I was like, "What are they doing?" Well, they like sugar, and they'll collect nectar at times to bring back to their nest. But they also eat. They're carnivores, and they eat insects. They're looking for insects. So when they're hovering around your plants, they're right. looking for maybe little aphids or mites or flies or caterpillars or so. So they're actually somewhat beneficial for your plants in that way. They serve as some pest control. So if you're not too uncomfortable or too freaked out by yellow jackets, let them do their work around your plants because they're patrolling the areas for potential pests like that. So there's a little good word for yellow jackets. And I didn't even go to Georgia Tech. So, all right, so we got that 2 minutes event.
That's right. Heal Utah has an event coming up tomorrow night on the 26th. As you know, Utah's been out of compliance for levels of PM2.5, the particulate matter in the air, for a decade. And right now the state is creating an important plan to reduce emissions in the years to come.
Right.
And they've been working on the plan for months. It's slated to be released later this fall. And so now's the time to give input. They are having an event, a community night, at the Marmalade Library in Salt Lake City, 6:30 p.m. tomorrow night. And you can join and join in with a group of people who's also working on the plan and giving some feedback. There are a lot of different, you know, actions that can be taken. And so they're saying now's the time to push for more meaningful and more forward-thinking options.
Right. They've had their challenges this summer in particular with ozone levels.
They've had
quite a few yellow, orange, I don't know if they had red days, but orange days are bad enough. So, all right, so that's go to healutah.org to learn more about, to get the specifics and details on that event. Mm-hmm. One last break, got to squeeze in, and then it's time to wrap up. We'll be right back.
Support for KPCW comes from the Natural History Museum of Utah, a nonprofit organization presenting Vikings Beyond the Legend. The exhibit destroys the one-dimensional stereotype of bearded barbarians with horned helmets. Learn their real story. See more than 400 authentic artifacts, some never before seen outside of Scandinavia. The Natural History Museum of Utah is located just minutes from Park City in the University of Utah's Research Park. More at nhmu.utah.edu.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. From kids' rope courses to zip lines and hiking trails to the bike park, Park City offers a wide range of family-friendly activities all summer long. More information on new summer activities and all the other programs can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hey, we got to thank our sponsors.
That's right. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Fail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services